Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, amid social distancing, a reminder that what might save us is social solidarity. We'll spend this hour with sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, whose research has found that a sense of shared responsibility for one another can save lives in a disaster. We'll talk about how crises can redraw the lines between political allies and adversaries alike and between left and right. And we'll learn why the choice to do things for other people can make us feel better and more in control. Our conversation starts after a short break. Like the perception of scarcity to drive demand. There was never any disruption in the production or distribution of toilet paper in America, but folks worried about shortages bought up so much that they created a shortage. But something different is starting to happen. People are reaching out to share with those who've run out of paper products, of food items, all kinds of things. They're distracting themselves from their own worries by sewing masks for family and friends and running errands for neighbors who can't risk a trip to a crowded store. For all it has taken away from us, and it's taken a lot, coronavirus has given the world a common enemy, and we can fight much harder if we work together. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Sociologist Eric M. Kleinenberg is here to talk about this unusual moment in human history. He is Helen Gould Shepherd Professor in Social Science and Director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at the New York University College of Arts and Science. He wrote recently about the need for solidarity in the midst of social distancing in the New York Times. Eric, welcome to Think.
Hey, thank you so much for having me and for using my middle initial. I never get that, so I feel especially honored.
Well, what is your middle name?
No, that's a question no one has ever asked me before. It is Martin.
All right.
For my maternal grandfather.
Very nice. I want to start by talking about the phrase social distancing. Those are the words that everybody's using. There's probably no point in trying to change them. But would it be better to call this something different, say physical distancing?
I am still trying to change those words. I think social distancing is not the right message. It sends us this idea that the way we get through this is to race home, take care of our household, close the doors, and come out on the other side. And that would kind of bring down the curve. That would keep, you know, each of our families safer. But there are enormous numbers of people out there who are extraordinarily vulnerable from this virus, older people, people with underlying health conditions, homeless people. And if we adopt a social distancing strategy, and that means turning our backs on them. And so I think the strategy we need to get through this really is physical distancing, as you said, physical distancing, and social solidarity, because it's social solidarity that allows us to lend a hand to people who will not get through this situation without some help. There are people who do not want to be outside right now, who cannot be outside, who should not be doing their own shopping for food or for groceries and medications. And they don't get through this unless we're looking out for each other. And then there's the whole next wave, which is the kind of post-pandemic economic recovery, which will require a level of solidarity we haven't had in generations.
You acknowledge that for the moment, staying physically apart seems to be the best method we have to slow the spread of COVID-19, but you also call it a crude and costly public health strategy. How does physical distancing hurt us even as we hope it might spare us?
Well, let me be clear. It's not that I'm acknowledging its importance. I am urging everyone to stay physically distanced. There is nothing more important right now than sheltering at home, if you can. There are some people who are going to do essential work, and we need them out there too. And that includes not just people working in hospitals, but, you know, cashiers and delivery people. There are a lot of people who are out there, like as I said, helping out neighbors by delivering meals if they're young and healthy and can do that. So we need physical distancing, but it's not a long-term sustainable way of organizing society. And we're seeing even in other parts of the world, places that have done a much better job than we have in the United States. And unfortunately, that's just about every other country. We're seeing them getting back to something more like a regular routine that involves kind of understanding how we can be physically distant even when we're in the public realm. But you can't retreat for a long period of time because there's clearly all kinds of other damage you do, and from that, economic damage especially.
I've been thinking a lot about the sacrifices we are asking of those who are in this emergency deemed essential workers. So I want to take nothing away from the extraordinary courage of people who choose to become healthcare workers, first responders, people who are in positions where they understand at the outset that they might at some point have to risk their own safety for the greater good. I'm not sure that the average, cashier at a Walmart or a Kroger was really expecting this when they signed on. And I don't know that, time and a half or $2 extra an hour or whatever it may be is really acknowledging the risk we're asking them to take.
I don't think it's acknowledging that at all. I think as we start to reckon with what this situation has asked of us, that we should be thinking seriously about what kind of bailout, what kind of recovery we want to give, what is a way of recognizing, honoring, possibly even compensating people who've put their own lives on the line in unexpected ways. So, look, there is a world of people who, make their living doing things that seemed quite ordinary before, and that includes cashiers. It includes people who clean buildings. It includes people who work in farms. There's a number of people. There's a lot of people who work in hospitals who are not doctors and nurses, by the way, and we've dramatically overlooked them in this process. It includes teachers who are keeping our kids engaged even while they're at home. There's a lot of people who continue to do essential work, and I think we're going to have to look at that work seriously when we get to the other side of the immediate health emergency. And maybe we'll start to rethink what it means to be interdependent and to take care of each other and not just think, as we have for the last several decades, that the market just on its own fairly compensates people at the right level, given the importance of their work.
We're used to thinking about social connections in our culture as something that is nice to have and something that can make us feel good. But until quite recently, we didn't probably think of them as literally essential. In emergencies like the 1995 Chicago heat wave, you've found that social connections meant the difference between life and death for many people.
It really did. The first book I wrote was a book about a heat wave that hit my native city. I grew up in Chicago, and it killed more than 700 people in just a couple of days. And at the time, that seemed like a really big disaster. It is a big disaster. It's just sobering to think that about the same number of people died yesterday in New York City, just in one city, as died in this kind of major American event. So what I learned when I looked closely at Chicago is that, heat deaths are so tragic because they're very easy to prevent. If you start to suffer from a heat-related illness, sometimes it can be hard for you to recognize it yourself. But if you have a contact, a social contact who sees you face to face, all they really need to do is get you exposed to water, or to get you into an air-conditioned environment. And if you do that, you can really save a life quite easily. And there was a lot of water available in Chicago in 1995. There was air conditioning available, not everywhere because there were power outages, but what people in Chicago couldn't get is social contact and social support. And so hundreds of people wound up dying alone. And social isolation proved to be what killed. And really starting with that research project, I came to appreciate the power of social connection, of social interaction, and social infrastructure, the kind of physical places that make our interaction so much easier in our everyday lives. And here is a moment now where it's very confusing because, in some ways, People who are fortunate enough to live in areas with strong social infrastructure before the coronavirus pandemic, probably have stronger social networks and are more likely to have someone reaching out to them, even, you know, in their neighborhood with a phone call. But at the same time, as we all know, it's not a moment where we should just go around having as much connection as possible. Every interaction is potentially dangerous. And so, you know, physical interaction is not the lifesaver that it was in the heat wave. It's something more complicated and even a little bit scary.
Yeah, I was in the grocery store the other day and I had a mask on, as did several of the other shoppers. I went early in the morning so it wasn't crowded. And I found that, you know, when you are trying to observe those 6 feet of distance, it almost feels shameful. I found myself I had to force myself to make eye contact because it felt strange to move away from a stranger as if they might be contaminated or as if I might carry some kind of contagion.
Of course, and there's all kind of signaling that we're struggling with now. I mean, this question about wearing a mask is complicated because the CDC is telling us we should do it. But there's something about going out in public and not being able to smile at someone, especially at a moment like this, that feels really painful. I mean, I think everyone is struggling because your impulse when people are sick is to want to reach out and hug them. If it's a family member, you want to go to be with them. And, you know, here we are at this moment where we're cutting ourselves off from each other in all the ordinary ways. And I guess the challenge now is to find a way of signaling, you know, somehow that, it, in fact, me not smiling at you because I've got a mask on or me keeping my distance is a way of expressing solidarity and love. In this specific and peculiar moment, the dangerous thing is to get too close, and the respectful and loving thing, is to raise a hand from a distance and just express that sense of solidarity because we're in it together, but we have to do it apart.
How did the United States become such a deeply individualistic culture as compared with other places where people are more inclined all the time to sort of think about what's good for the larger population rather than specifically what's good for them?
Well, that's a deep question, and one that I think we all need to be thinking about. You know, it was not always this way in the United States. We have had moments of profound solidarity. We have had large collective projects. You know, for instance, during and then after the Depression, most famously, Americans felt that they were overwhelmed managing things on their own. They realized that our individual resources were insufficient to get ourselves through hard times. Even the resources of, you know, ethnic communities or neighborhoods that had been able to take care of themselves and prided themselves on being able to take care of themselves, even they recognized it was too much. And so we mobilized collectively to ask the federal government to invest in us. And that's how we got these extraordinary New Deal programs that put millions of people to work and built new infrastructure, housing, parks, all kinds of things that we still use today. And I think we broke away from that model in recent years. Excuse me. In recent years, we've turned to a model which says, as Thatcher put it, you know, society does not exist. There's no such thing as society. We said the market will get us the best possible outcomes. We stopped investing in shared institutions and gathering places. We cut back on budget for all kinds of public facilities and have really let the market do its work. And that has worked out very, very well for some people. So we have some extraordinarily wealthy people and extraordinarily affluent and secure communities. And those are the places that will, you know, where we hear the calls that, you know, the United States has the best healthcare system in the world. There's no place as great as the United States. But I think we have also created a society in which the people who have not fared as well in the market have suffered tremendously. We've gone through this period where we see a decline in life expectancy for a number of white working class communities. We've seen a spike in these deaths of despair. And now we find ourselves in a crisis in which we don't really have the levels of trust and solidarity we need. And I think that's one reason the U.S. has been such a dangerous place the last several weeks.
Eric Kleinenberg is my guest. He's Helen Gould Shepherd, professor in social science and director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at the New York University College of Arts and Science. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, who directs the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University's College of Arts and Science. He wrote recently in the New York Times about the need for social solidarity, not just social distancing. Eric, what causes some people to become socially isolated as individuals?
Well, there are a range of pathways. I wrote a book a few years ago called Going Solo about the fact that there are more people who are living alone than ever before in the United States, and that's been a big shift. There's simply more one-person households than we've had in human history, not just in the United States, but around the world. You know, most people who live alone, and this is what I argued in this Going Solo book, most people are quite social, and they draw on our collective gathering places, you know, like libraries and senior centers and parks and diners and coffee shops for social life. And so typically living alone actually means being more social than people who are married. But now that we're in this situation, living alone means by necessity being isolated because we're being told we need to stay at home. And that has created an enormous social pain for people during this time. It is very difficult to be on your own for so long. And so we're all using social media and having meetings on Zoom and doing FaceTime and Skype, except there are a lot of people who don't have those technologies, right, and aren't comfortable with them or don't have access. And so for some people, this has become a very isolating experience.
What can we do about those folks who don't have access to digital communications, or they just don't know how to use the technology that's available now? How do we stay connected with them, especially if they're not like a distant relative that we could call? If it's just someone that we've never met before, but we're aware that they're in our neighborhood, what do we do for them?
Yeah, so the first thing I want to say is just to step back from this experience for the moment. If anything has shown us how important it is that we make internet access a utility, you know, a basic right, because you can't really be a citizen and a participant in our society at this point if you don't have home and internet access, and yet millions of people do not. We need, when we finish this event, to make sure that everyone is connected. Think about the fact that we're doing the census this year, and that is so much easier if you're online as well. But I think in a moment like this, you know, it's this question of how do we find, let alone reach out and help people who are older and on their own if they're not in our families already. You know, here I think we have to draw on the existing organizations that we have in regions like North Texas and around Dallas and cities throughout the United States. There are local government agencies that help to provide care for people who live alone, especially older people living alone and people with serious health issues. And there's lots of nonprofits and local organizations. In Chicago, where I grew up, there's this one called Little Brothers Friends of the Elderly that specializes in providing support to people who are old and on their own, many homebound. And I think it's a moment where everyone listening should be thinking about the people in their lives who are vulnerable now, and then people in their neighborhoods or communities who might be. And if you have the luxury of time or some resources, make some phone calls, you know, reach out to organizations and see what they need to provide help. It could be a Meals on Wheels program. It could be a religious organization, a church. It could be a community organization like the ones I've described, but it's on all of us who are more privileged in a moment like this, and I know all of us feel vulnerable, but if you have a little bit of time and if you have a little bit of money, or if you're young and you have health and you potentially could help to go deliver a meal, this is a time for us to be thinking about each other.
I've seen research that says men are more vulnerable to becoming socially isolated than women. What is the reason for that?
Yes, you know, that was one of the things that I found when I did my book about the heat wave in Chicago. You know, men are actually more likely to live with someone else than women. You know, women are more likely to live alone, but they're less likely to be isolated. Look, for a whole range of reasons, women have historically done a lot of the family work of maintaining social ties. You know, men went out to work, did their thing, but women organized the domestic social life. And there's a way in which I think, not in all societies, not in all communities, but in many, in the United States, girls and women do a lot of the heavy social lifting. And I think there's a kind of code of masculinity in many areas that says, the man should be a rugged individualist, whose job is to take care of himself and maybe take care of his household. But that's about it. And that might be changing. It's possible that, the younger generations are a little different. But on average, older American men have smaller social networks than older American women. And so they're at greater risk of isolation.
At this time when we need solidarity to get through this crisis as a collective, we're still fighting, I think, in some cases, decades of training. We're taught as children to fear strangers or at least view them with a wary eye. Why are we still so afraid of one another when crime rates are reaching near historic lows?
I'm not sure that we're as afraid of one another as that. I live in New York City. I live in a world of strangers. I'm surrounded by other people. And, it's extraordinary the level of civility that we have in New York, the extent to which we're able to live peacefully with one another and respect each other's space. Obviously New York has become one of the safest cities in the world, which is, a surprise for many people. But I don't really think the thing is that we fear each other that much. There are some groups that are discriminated against and stigmatized, and we certainly see fear of them. And I think we are divided as a society right now, perhaps like we haven't been since the Civil War. There's an enormous amount of distrust that political partisans feel towards one another these days. We obviously have quite divisive leadership at the national level, where we're told to identify enemies and oppose them. So I think we've turned against each other in other ways, but I don't know that we really fear each other. I wonder if you experience things differently there now.
And I will say, I guess I don't really fear strangers, but I guess I'm told that everybody's afraid. We hear about people running out. This is Texas that this show is produced in. And, we've heard about people interested in making sure they have enough guns and weapons in case things get worse than they are now.
Well, I do think that's a good point. And I think that, I think there is an anxiety generally that if things really fall apart, we will need to take care of ourselves and defend ourselves against people who will come, running for our food and our cars and things like that. But, that seems to me at the moment to be an exaggerated concern. Hmm. Miraculously, our supply chains are still working. There's a lot of food. Basic goods are available. People are, for the most part, if you think about how the situation has played out so far, it is extraordinary that we have the level of social distancing or physical distancing, the level of sheltering in place that we have in this country, and people are complying. We are not seeing an extraordinary spike in public violence. We are seeing, and this is something I think we really should be worried about, an incredible spike in domestic violence, people feeling trapped with an abusive spouse. That's a really serious issue. But here's an area where I think some stronger federal leadership could go a long way here, because when political leadership is transparent, when they're honest, when they respect the scientific evidence, when they show the public that they're really committed to the public health and well-being, and they will level with us, you get a high level of compliance, and you get a high level of, I think, trust in the system. And when Political leadership does the opposite when it seems manipulative and divisive, when it's not reliable, when it ignores science, when it seems arbitrary and potentially corrupt. Then you create a situation in which everyone feels like they better take care of themselves. And frankly, I think one reason why we see so much of this hoarding in the United States, why it's so hard to get, toilet paper and paper towels and masks and other medical supplies is because our level of distrust, not in each other, but in our political leadership is so bad.
How much of that is a factor of politicians saying you can trust us, but not the guys and gals on the other side of the aisle? In other words, it may be elected leaders who are telling us not to trust any other elected leaders except them.
Look, I think we're certainly seeing that. I mean, from my vantage, it's the really peculiar thing is that we need a strong federal government to set national policy and guidelines in a situation like this. You can't have a national shelter in place order without the president doing it. We have federal agencies that have enormous amounts of resources, but they have to follow and respect the scientific experts. And so, as I see it, there is that divisiveness, but we effectively have, one side of the aisle that's, pushing the country to pay heed and attention to what medical science is telling us, what public health tells us, what the evidence tells us. And we have another side that just seems kind of chaotic and arbitrary all over the map. And I think that's a really dangerous situation because it's that chaotic side that happens to be running the federal government right now.
So we've talked about solidarity and its importance on the level of communities, on the level of, the entire sort of domestic population of the United States. How important is it that we start thinking about being in this together with the other nations of the world?
Well, this is an unusual threat in that it's really something that is hitting all of us. And there's not a lot of global events that synchronize and potentially unify our species against some common threat. I mean, you could make the argument that the thing that's really similar to the coronavirus is climate change, global warming, which is another situation in which we're kind of all in it together very clearly. And look, I mean, we are seeing already that something that happens far away on the planet can get to us very quickly. And the reality is, when we talk about solidarity, we're talking about recognizing our interdependence. You know, the fact that my fate is linked to your fate if you're my neighbor. And when you live in a global economy, your neighbor is the person who lives in the neighborhood next to you, but it's also the person who, who lives in China or in Italy. Or in Mexico. And so what I think the coronavirus pandemic shows so vividly is the extent of our interdependence and the fact that if health conditions are really bad in other places, they can come to us very quickly too. Or like more locally, if we don't have a strong system of public education and our neighbor can't tell the difference between the flu and a new coronavirus strain because they've been failed to learn. They've been failed by an education system. They're less likely to comply with things. So I think yes, there's a real moment here where we can learn about our linked fate at the global level, and we can be divisive. We can turn against each other and say it's China's fault or it's Russia's fault or it's the United States' fault, and everyone is pointing the finger of blame. But we could also get out of this moment by trying to create a safer and saner system of global integration. And I think if we can pull this off for the coronavirus, and sadly we're still at a pretty early stage of this catastrophe, then potentially we can pull it off for something larger and more complex like the climate challenge.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Should we be concerned about governments taking more authoritarian actions in what may be legitimate efforts to slow the spread of the virus?
Well, by all means, we should be. We are seeing authoritarian governments around the world trying to seize power and reducing the civil rights and liberties of citizens. The level of surveillance, the depth of surveillance that we saw in China as a response to this should be chilling for Americans. And I think there's real open questions as to what kinds of surveillance systems we'll have in the United States next. Of course, we're talking today on a Tuesday, which is an election day in Wisconsin. And I think a lot of us today are scratching our heads about this decision from the Supreme Court that said, bizarrely, Wisconsin cannot delay its vote. Wisconsin cannot count late votes that were delivered, late because of the coronavirus pandemic, and strangely has pushed people out into a situation where voting requires putting themselves in jeopardy. So it's not just that our health is at stake in this moment. It's also that our democracy is at stake. And unfortunately, I think some of the people listening today probably are worried about what's going to happen in this country in November. I mean, it remains really an open question as to what kind of democratic process we will have. And I guess I'll just say one more thing on this point, which is, we have already started the biggest government economic stimulus and disaster relief package in modern history. We will be spending trillions of dollars very fast to deal with the massive unemployment and economic pain that comes from this situation. And the strange thing is, we're going to be doing this at a moment when our traditional pathways for expressing our democratic preferences, things like rallying at the mall in Washington, D.C., or marching in the park, or assembling at the state house, those things are shut down. There will not be the kind of conventional public sphere in the next weeks and months as we make these massively consequential democratic decisions. Instead, we'll be on Twitter and Facebook and Zoom meetings. And so it's really important that we think about how to use technology and how to use whatever kind of public space we have to express some democratic wish, because so much is at stake right now.
My guest is sociologist Eric Kleinenberg. He is director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at NYU's College of Arts and Science. He wrote recently in the New York Times about the need for social solidarity, not just social distancing. We'll be right back. Chris Boyd. My guest is sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, who is Helen Gould Shepherd Professor in Social Science and Director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at NYU. He wrote recently in the New York Times about the need for social solidarity during the COVID-19 crisis. Eric, at this point, it feels like we've been in this a long time. It's really only been a matter of weeks, but it's interesting. No one can say how long we will need to practice social distancing, whether certain parts of the country will let up before others. Do you think it's possible that prolonged social distancing could actually change the culture in lasting ways?
I think what's so strange about this moment is it feels like everything is up for grabs, and it's hard to constrain our sense of what's possible. I mean, I think we are going to enter into a period of social and political change that's unlike anything we've had in our lifetimes. This is a massive experience that we're having, and a profound one. My take now is that the people I'm speaking with cannot wait to get back to physical life again. They miss our gathering places. They miss the library. They miss the school. They miss the office. They want to be in a restaurant and a pub. They want to go to their kids' soccer games. I was actually supposed to be in Dallas this week for my son's soccer tournament. We can't wait to get back to those things. So I guess I think a lot of us are going to have a hard time with the transition. I think about my first ride on the subway in New York City when this ends, the first time I go out to a crowded restaurant or Washington Square Park. I mean, it's going to feel really odd for sure. But I think that, like other societies around the world that have already started to transition back, that we will get to another place. And what I hope is that the lasting cultural change is that we come to really recognize and appreciate how connected we are to each other, how much our fates are linked, and how some investment in each other's well-being, whether it's by building better health systems, or nicer parks, or better investing in better sick leave policies and things like that. I hope we come to realize just how much we all stand to gain from taking care of each other.
The stories about the 1918, 1919 influenza pandemic, a lot of them conclude with, you know, and afterwards people pretty much never talked about it. I'm thinking it's going to take an act of will for us to preserve and act on the lessons that we might be learning in this moment.
I agree. It's why I've spent so much time, writing and doing conversations like this in the last few weeks. There's going to be a fight over what happens next, and I think different sides will battle to try to establish the lessons. There will be different interpretations, and so, it is very much my view that this event has been a revelation. In that it has laid bare for us just how badly our systems perform when under stress. And for a country where so many people pride themselves on having the best healthcare system in the world, for instance, to see just the fundamental failures of our system to do things like get surgical masks and gowns, let alone hospital beds and ventilators, is really shocking. And for us to have waited for so many weeks and months to do something serious, while other countries did much more, and now to pay the price for it, it's a real reckoning. I mean, we should all remember that South Korea got their first case of COVID-19 on the same day that the United States did. And the differences between these two countries is shocking, and I think should be cause for scandal.
You already mentioned concerns about increased rates of domestic violence in families that are being confined together for an indefinite amount of time. I'm interested in families that are not toxic in that way. Is there any way for you to project whether this time together will be good or bad on balance for family relationships?
Oh, I mean, so many of us are so busy so much of the time that we don't spend enough FaceTime checking in with one another and savoring the relationships that we have. And so, this has been kind of, in some ways, this extraordinarily sweet moment for my nuclear family. I mean, I get to spend time with my children who are off and doing their stuff on their own in a way that I haven't before. And there is something lovely about that. We have grandparents on FaceTime or Skype, every day. We have these virtual meals together with friends who live in different parts of the country. There is more than just doom and gloom happening in the country right now. I think there are a lot of people who are coming to appreciate their relationships and how they matter, and how important it is to be kind and generous with one another. And so, I think there really is possibility to harness a lot of the good things from this otherwise horrible and scary moment.
I've been really interested to see that some of the traditional lines between Republican and Democratic Party priorities seem to be dissolving in response to this emergency. Like, a lot of what's happening now with the support of the right looks like the kind of big government they have long resisted. Certain policies like, closing the borders to people from different destinations has not been particularly objected to by people on the left. Do you think any of that might outlast the crisis?
I do. I think there are a lot of people in this country who have been, arguing against vaccinations, and I'm willing to bet that a lot of them are going to be first in line to get a vaccine for the coronavirus when it's available. And I think a lot of people are willing to say, look, this situation makes me see the world through different lenses. And I think we all recognize a kind of vulnerability that we might not have acknowledged before. I think we can see our linked fate in a way that we couldn't before. I think, I've read this incredible article, which maybe you saw the other day, about how strange it is for farm workers, many of whom are not, citizens, to suddenly be deemed essential workers by the federal government, and to be told that their status is protected and, ICE will not come after them now. I mean, we live with this incredible contradiction that doesn't get stated so clearly all the time. And one thing about a crisis like this is that it helps to make visible things that we, generally turn away from. And so I think a lot of us are going to come back to this from this with fresh eyes.
I guess it's also true. I mean, support for public health is motivated in part by a general sense of altruism, but it's solidarity, the sense that we're all in this together, that causes a lot of people to think, public health expenditures are a good idea.
That's right. And, look, if you create a public health situation that makes more people likely to catch and carry the virus, that obviously more people suffer. So, there have been studies that show that the absence of paid sick leave, in our health system means that American workers, even workers in the food industry, people who are serving us burgers and tacos when we go out to eat, are much more likely to go to work when they're sick. And of course, that puts not just their coworkers at risk, but all of us as well. And then, frankly, if you have a sick child during an ordinary time, and that, keeping that kid at home means that you have to skip work, and if you skip work, you might lose your job, and you certainly forego your pay for the day. You're more likely to send your sick child to school. So we have a bunch of policies in this country, that allow people to pay a little bit less in taxes, but I think one thing we're seeing now is that we pay a pretty steep price for them.
I want to talk a little bit about neighborhoods and how they're organized. One of the things you found when you looked at the 1995 Chicago heat wave was that, as disappointingly, but maybe not surprisingly, race and poverty played a factor in who survived and who didn't. But you could also take people who were demographically pretty much identical, but if their neighborhoods were set up in different ways, they had different faiths. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, the really striking thing about this part of the project is I started to look comparatively, in the same way that I've talked about the comparison between South Korea and the United States, in this disaster, you could talk about how New York City and San Francisco have fared so differently, right? But right now, both have strong ties to China. And you could imagine them both having strong early cases, but San Francisco was way ahead of the curve in social distancing, and treated this as an emergency health problem from the beginning, whereas New York really dawdled, and we can see the consequence of that. Well, in Chicago, what I did is I looked at different neighborhoods in the city to try to understand why the disaster proved to be so much more lethal in some places than others. And even I found that you could find, for instance, neighborhoods where the populations were identical, like two African American neighborhoods that are across the street from one another that have similar poverty rates and similar levels of older people living alone at risk of isolation, and dramatically different outcomes. And when I looked closely there, I found that, what really explained the difference, obviously it wasn't race, obviously it wasn't poverty, because they were the same in the two places. It was the quality of, what I've come to call the social infrastructure, that made a difference. And social infrastructure is, the set of physical places that shape our capacity to interact. So there are neighborhoods in Chicago that are, not just segregated and poor, but also they feel really depleted. They don't have much, they don't sustain a lot of public life because, the shops are closed down, and there's the parks are in bad shape, and the sidewalks are broken, and there's a lot of abandoned properties and empty lots. And those places really foster isolation, and they're especially dangerous for older people who don't feel so comfortable being outside. But then the neighborhoods that did really well, that were really resilient in the heat wave, were places that had a robust set of social infrastructures. They had a lot of gathering places, including diners and coffee shops and little libraries and community organizations and churches, places that brought people together on a daily basis. And so neighbors realized when someone didn't come out that maybe they needed help. And as with this situation, It wasn't social distancing. It was the connection of just reaching out to someone who was vulnerable and saying, is there anything you need? Is there a way I can help you? That wound up making the difference between life and death in Chicago. And so obviously this is not a situation with the coronavirus where, you want to just show up at your neighbor's door because the contact can be dangerous. But a different kind of contact, begin with a phone call, can really help someone know that they are loved and recognized at a moment when a lot of people feel lonely and isolated. And then if it turns out the person needs more, there are networks that you can activate that can get them their help. And I guess the question for us in this project now, if what we're trying to do is get through this crisis and to build solidarity, is why not start today? What can you do right now that involves reaching out to someone in your life or reaching out to an organization where you live and seeing what they need? And you might be surprised at how much need there is out there.
It's remarkable the moment you start thinking about someone who might have greater need than you, how much better you can feel about your own prospects, isn't it?
I think that's right. And by the way, this is another area where that turns out to be true generally in life. I mean, there are some people who tend to compare themselves to people who are a lot better than, in a better situation than they are. You're thinking about, why your house isn't quite as big as your neighbor's. And there are other people who tend to think about themselves in the context of people who have less. And the way that you make those kinds of comparisons in your emotional life is going to determine a great deal in how you feel at any moment and how you feel about the world. And look, I will tell you personally these last few weeks, because I'm talking to you from one of the most dangerous places you could be on Earth right now, unfortunately. And it is a very strange thing to feel a sense of your own fortune and privilege in the midst of such horrible suffering, even when you're there. And so I will acknowledge feeling a sense of anxiety about the situation. I'm human like everyone else. This is a very stressful time. It's a time of tremendous uncertainty. We don't know, where this is heading. And, in New York City, you hear the sirens and the ambulances going off every few minutes. It's a brutal moment. And, I don't know what comes next, but I know that I have this little period of time with people I love. And I am trying to savor those moments. And I'm also trying to think about people who are around me who could use a little hand and figure out what I can do, what people in my world can do. And I guess I don't want to end our conversation without emphasizing just how many ways there are to be helpful, even at a moment where you have to be physically distant.
Eric Martin Kleinenberg is director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at NYU's College of Arts and Science. He wrote recently about the need for solidarity during this time of social distancing in the New York Times. Eric, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Hey, thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed being here and I wish you good health.
You too. You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter, and we have a free podcast that you can find using any podcast app or at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.